This is the Beautiful Writers Podcast. Linda Sievertson here, coming to you from Los Angeles with today's guest host, the best-selling novelist Charles Saylor, who was our guest 2 months ago. Chuck is joining us from Colorado, and we are patching in one of our favorite authors. I've got goosebumps just gearing up to say his name. He's the New York Times best-selling author of many books, including Love Wins, Mr. Rob Bell, who's also in Los Angeles across town, although our phone connection is a little spotty at times here and there. But you guys, it's Rob. Rob is Rob. If you've read any of his many books, my favorite of which I think is How to Be Here Other Than This New One, or listen to his podcast, which is called Robcast, or seen him rock the church or Oprah stage, you know that he is so delightful and smart and funny and such an amazing heart that any minor technical static ain't nothing but a thing. I do what I can over here with my little self-produced endeavor. I am so honored to bring these two artists together. As you may recall, Chuck received global acclaim writing about religion and the Bible and the Son of God in his novel, The Second Son. And he's an awesome partner to help me interview Rob, who is currently on tour for What is the Bible? How an ancient library of poems, letters, and stories can transform the way you think and feel about everything. I want to say, though, that there's a problem when you interview Rob Bell. He says so many amazing things, you guys, that I had to force myself not to follow up on some of them because we were on a tight timeline. He's on tour. People are waiting for him. So if you're sitting there thinking, oh my God, Linda, he just dropped the most tantalizing detail. Follow the thread. Follow the thread. Read the book. That's what those things are for. I'm excited to dig in and expand my spiritual and writerly horizons with these two. Welcome.
Uncle, I am so happy you are here. Thank you.
Hey, kid, listen, I'm glad to be anywhere. And look, I'm really happy you asked me back. We had a good time doing that podcast together, didn't we?
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I can't tell you how many emails and calls I got from people saying that you were really their all-time favorite interview from this podcast. And I don't think that's too shabby for a guy in his 70s who's living out in the sticks in the Rocky Mountains.
Hey, watch it. I'm only 70. Let's not...
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I'm adding years on you.
Yeah, and living around Aspen isn't really considered out in the sticks of the Rocky Mountains.
Well, that's
I may be drinking peach tea, but I didn't put any moonshine in it.
You know what people told me made them fall in love with you on our call was you have this unabashed chutzpah, your sort of unwavering faith in yourself. I think that's, as we talked about, I think that's a byproduct of how you beat death as a young kid. But also our listeners sort of flipped for your living in the trenches writing tales and how you strong-armed the MGM movie studio. I don't think people can believe that, Chuck.
Well, you know, sometimes you have to protect your project, you know, any way you can. And going after the studio was the only way at that time that I could protect the Second Son. So you do what you have to do when you have to do it.
Yeah, well, it made for some good mythical stories that were true. All right, so I want to talk about our guest, Mr. Rob Bell. My God, if there is anyone I binge read or binge listen to, it's Rob. It doesn't matter how many times I read him or listen to his audiobooks, sometimes at the same time, they never get old, and I always, always have ahas. I know you're the same, right?
Yeah, I am. His book last year, Be Here Now,
yes,
reminds me so much of your friend Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art.
Totally.
It really does, which, as probably everybody already knows, is timeless and cutting edge, and I think Rob is the same thing. His work at least has enabled me to experience a reinterpretation of my own long-held beliefs about certain passages in the Bible.
Yeah.
And he's provided me with kind of a fresh look at what's below the surface. I know I'll never take anything literally again.
Right? And, you know, that says a lot coming from you. Your book, The Second Son, sold 6 million copies. So I think that this new book of Rob's, What is the Bible, is some of the most jaw-dropping information on religion and biblical times that I've ever heard, certainly. And You know, while it's different than The Second Son, obviously, your book was a novel and his is nonfiction, they're so similar in the way that they both uplift and how they're page-turners. Both books are page-turners.
Yeah. In his passage about Jonah and the fish and everything, I noticed he used a phrase, and I'm going to paraphrase, that the nature of the story is simply great storytelling. Mm-hmm. Because the author has a larger point to make. And when I read that, I said to myself, oh my gosh, you, Rob, are the storyteller.
No.
And you've kind of taken up God's call to be a light to all of us, you know, his readers, and refresh us. I mean, there's so much that I've learned from reading What is the Bible, that it actually makes me want to go back to the Bible, but I also don't want to miss out on what he has to say. It's so refreshing.
Well, and you're bringing up something that I think is the reason that I wanted to put the two of you together. What you have in common, you have several things in common to me, but what you have in common so obviously is this talent for being a world-class, you're both world-class storytellers. And I don't say that lightly. You know, it's one thing to be a good writer, but it's another talent altogether to be able to hold people's attention while speaking the way that the two of you do. You're both page turners, both on the page and for our ears, if you will.
Well, thanks, kid. It's kind of like air movies, I guess. You know, as we talked about in our episode, you know, I got that from falling asleep every night in the late 40s and 50s listening to the old radio shows. And thank God my parents gave me a radio.
Yeah.
And being a product of that time, I think that's where my storytelling came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love to know where Rob's came from, because it can't be all from writing sermons and preaching. There's something in there that we have to ferret out today to find out where this great storyteller has gotten his impetus for this.
Let's bring him on, shall we?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, Rob, where are you, bud?
Hello, my friend.
How is it to be hearing people just talk about you while you're sitting there pretending like you're not there?
Just keep going. Fascinating. Out-of-body experience.
Well, it is such an honor to have you here. I want to start by just thanking you. Thank you, thank you. And I want to ask both of you about writing these lives of Jesus. Okay, so Rob, in your instance, you're talking about the actual Jesus. And with Chuck, he's talking about the second Son of God. But I want to know about how writing about these bigger-than-life characters has changed you. So Rob, starting with you, how did writing this book change you?
Well, in some ways, writing the book was in response to what changed me. I realized that these Bible stories and how I had learned to read them had done something to me at a deep level and really shaped me. I literally thought, I should just sit down and start typing stuff that's in my head about the Bible, almost like to free up storage space and get it out on the page. And it was like 50,000 words, 75,000 words, 100,000, like it just all came out very, very quickly, as I just kept thinking, well, that story, there's that twist, and people should know that. And, oh my word, there's that one little subtle innuendo there, and that's actually opens up that, which connects with that. So in some ways, it was realizing just how this ancient library had worked on me for so many years and how it had done so many things to me and how it had shaped the way I see the world, and I should try to put that all in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it happened. It didn't take that long. It was the easiest book to write of my books, which I think is really interesting.
So it sounds to me like you've been steeped in this information your whole life.
No, actually not. I mean, I've gone to church, but the Bible always raised that existential question, what's for lunch? You know what I mean? It was like boring. It was like, oh, whatever. I found the Jesus stories interesting. But it wasn't until my early 20s that I started, it's almost like it went from black and white to color.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I was like, wait. And the realization, the people who talk the most about the Bible don't have actually any idea what it's about. And the people who use the biggest lofty words actually are missing it. That was part of the reveal. Yeah, that's what got me going.
I love how you were preaching very early in your career, and somebody that was teaching at the same place you were came up and said, hey, you missed it. And
it was like a random guy. It was literally a random guy I'd never met, just walked up. He was like, oh, you're totally missing it. Jesus was Jewish. All this stuff, all those stories that you just, that passage that you just did.
Yeah.
There's all this stuff going on in there. All this innuendo and background and history and reference. Mm. And you just missed it all. I'll never forget it. It was like, what is this guy talking about? What in the world? Then I just went down the rabbit hole. Then it was, he started copying these articles off at my office, and suddenly this book, which sort of existed in some other realm, became a book about this world and about money and politics and energy and power and creativity and economics and all the things we're talking about right now.
It like, oh, exactly.
It became something way sweatier and sexier and dirtier and grittier, and yeah, it got legs and arms, and you know what I mean? Yeah, it all changed.
And that's what I love about how you made it come to life by bringing us into the history and the language of the time and explaining what things meant then and how they've been so easily misinterpreted. Just listening to you, I love it on audio, I've read it and listened to it, but listening to you and your enthusiasm and excitement for the grittiness and the juiciness of it and the sexuality of it makes it just a completely different book than the book I grew up with.
Right. You know, comedians invite you to laugh with them. A good comedian does not try to make you laugh. They invite you to laugh with them. And for me, the worst thing about the Bible is like, I'm going to tell you what it says. Oh, I'm already bored. But I'm going to dance with it in public, and you're welcome to hear the music if you'd like.
Well, I just want you to do the whole Bible, Rob.
Right?
Well, actually, I think that I'm going to release some things like 10 and 20 hour audio projects where I take through a whole book.
Oh,
because
that's a good idea.
I think I'm going to do the book of Leviticus, and then I think I'm going to do the book of Daniel and just take people through. Here's a way to read this. It's just so much more interesting. It's interesting also on doing interviews for this book and doing a bookstore tour, how many people have a conflicted relationship with the Bible.
Oh, sure.
And which is sort of like, lots of people do, but it's interesting to I just tell people you don't have to have a conflicted relationship with the Bible. It's fascinating to me how just saying that, how many people, that's like a new idea. Well, you don't. Like, if you think that passage is barbaric and evil and horrific, then you can just say that. And you don't have to go kill everybody in the village in the name of your God. You don't have to.
You know what? Speaking of, you gave me such an insight as to that whole killing everybody. So I watched the Game of Thrones. It's one of my favorite shows. And I turned to my fiance early on in the first season, and I said, I know this is based on real history, medieval history. What the hell? Why do people go in and kill an entire village? What is behind that? And I never understood it until I read this book. And can you briefly encapsulate that for people? Because that was such an aha for me about why that happens in our history, and it made so much sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. Our world, so many modern people, there's a certain arrogance that can come with the modern world, where you assume that all human beings prior to you saw the world the same way that you do.
Right.
So even just when you read an ancient text, just stripping yourself of all of the assumptions about how they would have seen the world can do wonders. So in a tribal culture, just staying alive is winning, just surviving. And so you would name how many fighters you had in your tribe. You would procreate. You'd have lots of sex. They have lots of babies. They have lots of kids. So they'd grow up to be fighters so you could defend your tribe. Or if you were in an agricultural setting, you'd have lots of kids in order to have workers on the farm in order to grow enough food that you wouldn't starve. So just so many assumptions we have about food, children, procreation, allegiance, tribe, blood, family. Ancient societies just didn't have, and you would go into battle against a different tribe, and if you didn't wipe them out, they might come and wipe you out, or they might form an alliance with another tribe, and now it's two against one. Now you're really in trouble.
These stories
just reflect like a dominant consciousness of the day. Everybody had their gods,
yeah,
like their totems they take into battle. And so you would fight in the name of your god. And if you won, then your god had there. And that's what's happening in the David Goliath story is it's a god versus a god. And the humans are sort of acting out whatever's happening in the sky. Mm-hmm. And this is how people saw the world. It's yeah. very early. And sometimes people immediately put it into right and wrong categories. It's probably best to start with earlier and later. That's
yeah.
earlier in the story. That's how people saw things. And then we kept going.
We evolved.
Things changed.
We yeah. evolved. Chuck, can I ask you, so back to that original question, how did writing about Joseph, the second son of God, and having that be such a global phenomenon at the time, you had the largest print run of any book in the United States. It was published all over the world. How did that change you?
Well, it scared the hell out of me. You know, when I was writing Second Son, I used to go to bed at night and pray to God and say, look, if this is blasphemous, just blow some pages off the dining room table, which is where I wrote. And if they're on the floor in the morning, I'll stop. But, you know, it had such a profound effect. When I came home from the tour, I came home to, I think I mentioned to you, about 40,000 letters.
Yeah.
In 8 weeks.
8 weeks, Rob.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And people were saying they'd given up all these vices in their lives. They'd given up drugs and drinking and beating their wives and children, and it had changed their lives. And, you know, for me, Rob, the reason I wrote Second Son was because of Job 1:6. And I know you know what it is, and I'm going to paraphrase what I remember, but it says basically, and the day came when the sons of God came before the Lord, and Satan was amongst them himself. And is that correct?
I'm going to go from memory. It sounds about right. I can go grab a Bible if we need to, but I like your version.
You do? Well, yeah.
You're on a roll. Just keep going.
Yeah, so because of that passage and because I took it literally, which I will never do again, I promise. I promise. I will dig deeper. But because of that passage was the reason that, or my foundation as proof that there could be another Son of God at some time with a whole nother message for mankind. And because of that, I wrote the Second Son, and it had a profound effect on the readers and certainly had a profound effect on my life.
Now, can I ask, I want to talk about this. Rob, if you had to use one piece of scripture to address our political climate right now, what would it be?
There's this passage where Joshua is going into battle early in the Bible, Book of Joshua, and he comes around the corner and there's an angel of the Lord, lightning bolt sound, standing there in the way. And he says, whose side are you on? And the angel says, neither, but you are standing on holy ground. I love it. Whose side are you on? Because that's everything for Joshua is oppositional. It's duality. It's are you on my side or their side? Are you enemy? Are you friend or foe? Everything for him is split into two groups.
Yeah.
And the angel says, neither. Neither. I love it. Mm. I love it. But you're on holy ground, so you should probably bear yourself with a little more respect. Oh, I love that. I could go all day on that.
Mm. Chuck, when you look back on Joseph and you think of him as a character, what would he say in this political climate? He was into social resistance, right? Anything that robbed people of their dignity.
Yeah, he felt that mankind had given away that inherent power that they should have kept for themselves. They gave it away to big business and organized labor that told them when and if they could work, and to the government that told them how much of their money they could keep and then decided for itself where to spend their money, their taxes, and some of the larger religious institutions that told you what's right and what's wrong and who to love and who to hate. And eventually, whether you were good or bad, and then whether you went to heaven or hell, you know, and Joseph just felt that people should take that power back and use it for good. And, you know, it struck a chord. For me, in The Second Son, when I first started writing it, Joseph fulfills a prophecy told to Pope Nicholas in 1447 by the Archangel Uriel, that every pope from Nicholas IV should look for a man who can fall from the highest mountains and be unscathed, a man who can walk through the fires of hell and be unburned of flesh, and a man whose heart would be so pure that it could not be stopped until after Good Friday of his 33rd year. And that man would be another son of God with a new message for mankind. And I kept having and I didn't know why, in the novel, I kept having everything seem to occur at 9:23. The book opens up with an iron worker, Joseph Turner, falling off of a building and living through the fall, and that occurs at 9:23. And it wasn't until I went back to the Bible and went to Mark 9:23 that I realized that maybe that's why I used 9:23. And again, I'm going to praise, but Mark 9:23.
That's fantastic.
All things are possible to him who believeth. Mm. So I hope that answered your question, Linda.
It did. And one of the things I love about both of you is you make the women in Jesus's life or in biblical times come to life. And there's so much more powerful women than I was brought up to hear about in church. So, Rob, can you talk maybe about Joanna and the bomb that was dropped about her?
I thought that was great.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the Gospel of Luke, there's almost like a throwaway line, like, oh, by the way, there are these women who traveled with Jesus, and Joanna was the wife of Cusa, who was the manager of Herod's household, and she paid Jesus, these women paid Jesus bills, which is such a fantastic economic statement. I mean, it's so countercultural and ahead of its time and subversive, and it's astounding for its time and place. And then if you realize that the Herodians were sort of the local government, and they were very oppressive and nasty, and Herod himself wants Jesus killed,
right?
And Herod's household is run by Cusa, and Cusa's wife is Joanna, then you're like, oh, Joanna would have been a wealthy woman who ate well and was the elite of the elites, but she has chosen to align herself with the Jesus movement, which is solidarity with everybody who's being oppressed by Herod's kingdom. And she would have had money because her husband would have been a wealthy man, but his wealth would have been directly derived from Herod. And Herod, we know, is trying to kill Jesus. So Herod is trying to stamp out a movement that he is indirectly funding, which there's no way the Gospel of Luke writer didn't think that was really awesome and funny and unexpected. That is just so beautiful. I can't stand it. But it's also interesting because in doing interviews for this book, women who have said, why would I read a book that has nothing to say to women? And I would just begin with, that's a great question. You should have that question. It's also interesting all of the ways in which this book is ahead of its time when it comes to women, which doesn't mean we still have a long ways to go, but all of the, some scholars call them breakouts, which are Judges chapter 5, there's a woman who leads the nation of Israel into battle. That was unheard of.
Yeah.
So, yes, the Bible does reflect a very patriarchal culture that is thousands of years old. It also, at the same time, doesn't follow form. And women are often the instigators in stories, the strong ones. I mean, the Jesus resurrection stories center around women who are true to him when all the men abandon him. You have all the way through these very strong, fierce, defiant women who take initiative and actually are the catalysts for a lot of the action, which I don't think a lot of women know that. So I completely understand the frustration and like, why would I ever read that? And yet, what does it look like for human society to move forward, for women to be more empowered? What does progress look like? and you actually see it unfolding in these stories, which is just fantastic. Let alone Joanna, who's the wife of Huza. Good Lord, that's just fantastic. There's a woman, there's Mary who had seven demons. There's also another woman named the Other Mary, which I think is awesome to go down in history as the Other Mary. I mean, that's just, of all the names, the O is capitalized. I mean, the poetry of it alone, fantastic. The Other Mary.
Oh, my gosh. So I want to talk about this idea of the muse. Knowing Chuck as long as I've known him, basically my whole life, in my opinion, he channeled a great portion of the Second Son.
Mm-hmm.
And my question to you is, Rob, when I read your books, it feels to me like otherworldly writings. I'm so mesmerized by your work, as so many people are. Do you ever feel that you're a channel?
Yes. Well, it's interesting when Chuck was talking about Job and how a random verse in Job somehow unlocked something in him that led to this beautiful story. That's a very straightforward, honest explanation, and it also has like 5,000 miles of mystery built into it. You know what I mean? Like, it's actually what happened, and yet I have 100 more questions now. You know what I mean? Like, where does that sort of inspiration in the narrative and then 9:23? And I would say I can resonate with that. There are straightforward answers to why you made what you made and wrote what you wrote and were feeling what you're feeling. But baked into them are, I don't know. I just followed it where it took me.
Yeah.
I pursued a line of inquiry. I wrote the next sentence, and then the next sentence came.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied and I worked hard and I was disciplined and I did research. I also have no idea where it came from. You know what I mean?
So it sounds a little bit like our friend Liz Gilbert talks about following your curiosity.
Yeah, you're like putting in your hours, but you're also aware that you are opening yourself to great mysteries of how things get made. There's this Latin phrase, ex nihilo, out of nothing.
Oh, I love
that. There's this nature of creativity. It comes out of nothing. Jerry Seinfeld was asked where his jokes come from. There's this great line where he says, I have no idea. I literally have no idea.
Oh, my
God. What in the world? I just wrote a kid story called A Goat for a Boat and read it to my daughter's class and then read it on the last episode of my podcast. I have no Ron and Don, and one has a goat and one has a boat. And this girl
so
named
funny.
Eileen V shows up with a vat full of chili that was made by her brother Willie, so it's Willie's chili. That is just completely ridiculous and absurd, and I have no explanation other than for some reason I came up with a story about a guy named Ron who has a boat and a guy named Don who has a goat.
But you know what's interesting to me about this conversation right now is I wrote a question for you this morning about Jerry Seinfeld. Because when I was prepping for this, I saw in my mind's eye Jerry and his work ethic of going to comedy places, right, every single night and working jokes for years sometimes before he ever spoke them out loud in a bigger venue. He would just work the jokes and work the jokes. And that is so not unlike you. You were out doing state fairs and little tiny rooms all over the country working your material, not unlike
Absolutely.
A comedian.
Absolutely. And I have a new 2-hour one-man show that I'm going to take around the world next year for like all of 2018.
Yeah.
And I was just, it's all coming together and it's all these stories that I've never told. It's like 2 hours connected with something that this scholar said in the 1800s, connected with a Hebrew poem, connected with something that happened to me in 1999. It's just the weirdest. Well, it's like all my stuff. It's just a weird mishmash of stuff. But the how these stories are all talking to each other and how it has a central theme and how it's all talking to itself and how it's forming itself into this next tour. And it's like lots of work. And it's also, I'm like watching it out of body. Wow, look at this. Look where this is coming. Interest. Oh, you're right. That could go after that. And if I finished with that and then alluded to that, oh, it's, that's the juice. That's the great joy of it.
Rob,
the joy
of you're going to do this tour as Rob Bell. But if you were to choose a character from history to do this tour, for you to be a different character than yourself, in this 2-hour piece of work, who would you choose to be? Who would tell this story to the audience?
I would be Joshua Slocum, who lived in the 1890s in Boston, and he went out into the woods and chopped down a tree, and he dragged it back and cut it up and made planks, and then he took those planks and he rebuilt an old boat that somebody had given him, and then he got in the boat and he sailed around the world alone. No one had ever done it. And he wrote a book. No one had ever done this before. He wrote a book about his experience called Sailing Alone Around the World. And I would do it as him because the stories about him are unbelievable. He tells about what it was like to sail into a port where the people still believe the earth was flat. He's the weirdest historical character that for some reason I really identify with. I'd have him do it. Because just so I could sit in the front row and watch him do material, because that would be really entertaining to me.
If you did it as Joshua Slocum, would that free you up
right.
even more to impart to us? I mean, I'm just blown away with how much I've learned from your most recent book and how I feel more awakened.
That's amazing.
Which I really appreciate, especially at age 70. I really needed to be reawakened.
Yeah, but you feel pretty awake and pretty young.
He is.
I think you're about as awake and young as they come for 70.
He totally is. He is such a rascal. Okay, so I have a total random question. When you eat junk food, Rob, do you pray that it will be good for you?
No.
Do you eat junk food?
Like, what do you mean?
Ice cream, cake.
I don't do ice cream and cake. I think potato chips are one of the greatest foods ever. I feel terrible if I don't eat well.
I know.
I try to keep it on the up and up.
So when I interviewed years ago, I interviewed Arnold Palmer. It was maybe 20 years ago. And I asked him about prayer. I said, do you pray on the golf course? And he said, no way. He said, I have never once prayed for God's support during a golf game. He said, I don't want to involve God in such small details. So my question to you is, do you pray when you're about ready to go on stage or when you sit down to write?
Yeah, I think in a much more integrated way that there's hopefully a conscious connection throughout the day. But yeah, I will have specific moments. This morning I wrote out 2 pages of things that were inside me that needed to be coughed up and sort of turned over. And yeah, definitely sometimes before going on stage or just discernment about some email that I don't know what this thing is. What is this? What's the next right thing with this? Yes or no? Or do I, anything sticky, anything that's got edges that I can't, I will. Yeah. Sometimes I'll just take a deep breath. A guy just gave me some beads. The other night I held those and just put my fingers over the succession of beads and that. I was just hugged by Amma, the
huggy
from India, and she gave me a bracelet. So I was holding those beads. Yeah.
Everyone I know who has been hugged by Amma has had such miracles.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me.
When you were writing this book, how did you start your day? When would you start? How long would you write? I know when I was writing, I could only write for about 3 hours.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't write any longer because my mind would turn to mush.
Right. And I'm so interested. I have heard that from so many people, which is true for me. There's like a window. It opens and then it closes. And from there on, your brain, the rest of the day, you got nothing. So it's like you just figure out your window and show up during that window. I'm the same way. When I meet people who went away for 2 weeks and wrote their book and they wrote for 12 hours a day, I have no idea what you're talking about. That doesn't make any sense to me. But yes, so I would say there's a 3-hour window in the morning. And then
that's what it was for me too.
And
from
then,
about 9 to 12.
Thank you. There you go. And that this book of the Bible was written, make my kids breakfast, take them to school, and then there's a window. That's exactly when this was written. And then at noon, we go surfing. That was how this book got written, for sure. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
When I finally embraced how tiring writing is, something within me, my wife always says it's not a tough guy contest. Once I was ready to say, oh, wait, writing's actually very, very tiring, then I could own up to, oh, yeah, so a couple of hours of this and you're pretty much cooked. You need to go do something else. Yes.
Yeah, it's not tiring. It also, it makes you hungry. The women at my retreat, we eat like wolves. We're ravenous 3 times a day at these huge feasts. And everyone judges it. Hardly anyone really gains weight because it's concentrated, right? They are writing for 10 hours a day, which is not normal in their lives. And then they're just starving.
And it's ex nihilo. It's out of nothing. A lot of things, like if you're going to go do something next Tuesday, Tuesday is going to come, whether you're prepared or you've done the work or not.
Yep.
Because it will arrive in time. But the nature of writing is it will not arrive in time. It will arrive in space through time, and that will only happen if you actually give it birth.
Yep.
And that is a very different kind of creative energy. Because if somebody in business is going to have a meeting, whether they ever did any preparation, the meeting's still going to come, and you can build your whole career on meetings. But this, if you don't actually make your fingers move on the keys, nothing gets made. And that's... Oof.
Yeah, you have to put your feet to the fire.
Absolutely.
You do.
And there's this tremendous narrowing of energy, because there's 1,000 things you could be doing with your energies, and your energies naturally want to diffuse. Hey, ESPN.com. Hey, look, there's something in the yard. I probably should trim that branch. Oh, one of my kids just said something. The very nature of energies is they will naturally dissipate, but to focus them, which means you have to say no to every single other thing you could do with your energies, but this one sentence requires such a ferocious discipline. And I think you actually have to have a funeral for all the things you're not going to do.
Thank
you. Decide to write a book.
Thank you.
You actually have to grieve all the we love possibilities. Possibilities and openness feel so free and easy. But when you're actually going to make something, you have to have a funeral for all those possibilities because you've chosen this one. And once you can get through the grieving, then you're fine. But I actually think that's what's happening sometimes with people, is they don't know what the resistance is. They don't know what this thing is. And you're going to have to die to everything else. And this thing you make might be rubbish. And you have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Oh, and I went through that too. When I wrote Second Son, I was so afraid that nobody would like it.
Right. Right.
That nobody would see what I saw in the piece and was pleasantly surprised. For me, Second Son was a real gift from God. And I've said that since day one. You know, I may not pray a lot to God, but I sure thank him a lot.
Yeah.
But can I just say for a second, I want to ask you guys about how the writing life can make you feel crazy. Because as I'm listening to you, Rob, talk, I'm thinking about my fiance, who he will leave in the morning, sometimes at 4:30, 5 in the morning. And by the time he's cleared all of his email in the morning, I'm just finishing walking the dogs. I sit down. I try to get organized. And by the time he comes home, I've wrestled this brain so hard to get these pages down and avoiding the call of the laundry and avoiding all these things that are pummeling me for attention. And I'm exhausted. And he looks at me and he's like, "Why are you tired?" Because I think non-writers don't really understand what a battle it is, like you were talking about, for your energy to get that compressed and that focused. It can be agonizing to try to be in the real world at times. Is it for you guys? Because for me, it can be really hard.
Absolutely. And your mind is elsewhere.
Exactly.
You're trying to, sometimes you're just trying to solve a problem.
Yep.
And the only way is to let your mind just turn it over and over and over, which is very different than figuring out why the water filter is beeping.
Thank you. And doesn't it make you feel like an asshole? It makes me feel like an asshole sometimes. Like, I just can't join civilization because I've got my mind on this paragraph. It's like, what a jerk.
You know, right. You have to surrender the obsession with metrics and data. Because for many people, their work is directly tied to tangible outcomes. they worked this many hours and this many clients were served, this many deals were transacted. And when you enter into this kind of territory, all you knew is you spent 8 hours figuring out how the blue shoes related to the stepdad and the Toyota, right? All you know is you're trying to figure out that scene or that chapter, and it's just a totally different kind of work.
Oh, my God. One of my favorite parts of your book, How to Be Here, you're talking about how you have to work something and work something and work something. And I was thinking about, I did a TED Talk last year, and it took me 6 months to memorize this thing, because as I was working it, I kept changing it and changing it. It was the most crazy-making, obsessive, scary, fun, alive process where I felt like I was throwing myself off a cliff. It's actually going live this week, and I'm terrified. But that obsession of working something and reworking something, it almost feels like a mental disorder, does it not?
For all of us. What's your TED Talk about this time?
Oh, it's about time debting, which the only time I really time debt these days is when I'm working on the talk about time debting. Time debting, just real quickly, because I know we need to wrap this up, but time debt is the idea where with financial debt, you spend money you don't have. And time debting is even maybe more widespread and dangerous, because this is where you're spending time incorrectly for your life. So you're going into debt with time and you're losing sleep or losing your health and all these other things. It's quite dramatic. So at any rate, I've really gotten a hold on it. You know, when my marriage broke up, I had 60 all-nighters in 1 year to get my work done and save the house and save the kid and all
Whoa.
Of it. Yeah, 60 all-nighters. It was brutal. So I've had to rewire. I've had to really change and not be a workaholic and not pull all-nighters anymore. And so that was the topic of this TED Talk. Well, in order to do it well, and in order to stand up in front of 1,000 people with a memorized 13-minute speech and not fall on my face and forget my lines, I had to go into time debt. So there you go. There's
wow.
Well, Linda, never forget that God gave us time so everything wouldn't happen all at once.
But just to close on that idea of when you two are working on something that diligently, Rob, your books, it's so obvious you've worked this material so because it's flawless. Your writing is flawless. Do you ever feel obsessive? Do you ever feel like I said, it's a mental disorder to work something that much?
Yeah. Sometimes I'll be trying to come up with language to describe something. It'll just turn over and over and over. And I will realize, other people get done with work and they go home and don't even think about it. And this is just what I do.
Yeah.
I think for me, the path was this work, it exists in some other category. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And if I keep looking around trying to figure out why my work happens to be this way and why this tires me and this energizes me, I think I just died to all of the need to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of at some point, it just got too tiring. Like, I'm just going to do this and just let it be whatever it is. But yes, I do like obsession, or I think now I've just made peace with it and it feels a lot less obsessive because it's just, this is the work. This is what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it takes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I totally relate to that. That's really good to hear. I totally relate to that.
And I love how you talk about it's a great mystery. Creation is a mystery. Something comes out of nothing, whatever it is,
yes.
A school, a business, a sculpture, a network, a family. But you say yes
right.
to your life and the path unfolds. It's beautiful.
Right. Well said.
Thank you so much for showing up, you two. What a delight. I really appreciate it. I know it's super last minute. We had scheduling snafus all over the place this week, all of us.
You're fantastic. It's great.
So delightful.
Both of you. It's so wonderful to meet you. Amazing.
Well, it's wonderful to meet you too, Rob, and I just want you
very
to know
inspiring.
That now my favorite chapter in the Bible is anything you lead me through.
Oh.
Well, that is the best. I'll make some more long stuff just for you. I'll make some long stuff.
Yeah, I appreciate it, really.
This is
you're
my
a
man,
joy.
And here you go. That's great. That's great. That's very meaningful to me. Thank you.
You're very welcome, and it's well-deserved.
Great. Wonderful talking with you all.
Best of luck on this new book. Everybody, you've got to get this book. You're just going to love it so much. And until next time, boys.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye, Chuck.
God, I wish we could have gone longer. Remember to get your copies of What is the Bible and The Second Son. They are way sexier and summer beach readie than they sound. Oh, and as for that TED Talk that we talked about, the one on time debt that put me into time debt to give, all kidding aside, my parents died way too young, both deep in time debt, and I think I was headed in the same dangerous direction. This is a topic very near and dear to my heart, something that affects nearly everyone, and yet few have ever heard of it. I'm on a mission to change that, so I would love to share it with you. And if you like it, maybe you can give it the thumbs up and share it with your communities. Getting out of time debt is the number one way I know of to support not only your health and sanity, but your art and your writing. You can find this TED Women Talk by going to Google or YouTube and typing in these three little words, time, debt, TED, and it'll pop right up. You can also watch it at timedebt.com. As always, thank you for joining us. I love our listeners, and I treasure this time we spend together more than you know. Until next time, write on.